Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Chapter 9 of The Madman and the Pirate. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read and recorded by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, August 2007. The Madman and the Pirate by R. M. Ballantyne. Chapter 9. Who shall tell, or who shall understand, the thoughts of Richard Roscoe, the ex-pirate, as he wandered lost, yet regardless, in this dismal swamp? The human spirit is essentially galvanic. It jumps like a grasshopper, bounds like a kangaroo. The greatest of men can only restrain it in a slight degree. The small men either have exasperating trouble with it, or make no attempt to curb it at all. It is a rebellious spirit. The best of books tells us that greater is he that ruleth it than he that taketh a city. Think of that, youngster, whoever you are, who readeth this. Think of the conquerors of the world. Think of the great Alexander, whose might was so tremendous that he subjugated kingdoms and spent his life in doing little else. Think of Napoleon the Great, whose armies ravaged Europe from the Atlantic to Asia, who even began, though he failed to finish, the conquest of Africa, who made kings as you might make pasteboard men, and filled the civilized world with fear as well as with blood and graves, all for his own glorification. Think of these and other great men, and reflect that it is written, "He who rules his own spirit is greater than they." Yes, the human spirit is difficult to deal with, and uncomfortably explosive. At least so Richard Roscoe found it when, towards the close of the day on which his enemy chased him into the dismal swamp, he sat down on a gnarled root and began to reflect. His spirit jumped almost out of him with contempt when he thought that for the first time in his life he had fled in abject terror from the face of man. He could not conceal that from himself, despite the excuse suggested by pride, that he had half believed Zeppa to be an apparition. What, even, if that were true? Had he not boastfully said more than once that he would defy the foul fiend himself if he should attempt to thwart him? Then his spirit bounded into a region of disappointed rage when he thought of the lost opportunity of stabbing his enemy to the heart. After that, unbidden and in spite of him, it dropped into an abyss of something like fierce despair when he recalled the past, surveyed the present, and forecast the future. Truly, if hell ever does begin to men on earth, it began that day to the pirate. As he sat in the twilight on the gnarled root, with one of his feet dangling in the slimy water, his hands clasped so tight that the knuckles stood out white, and his eyes gazing upwards with an expression that seemed the very embodiment of woe. Then his spirit lost its spring, and he began to crawl, in memory, on the shores of other days. He thought of the days when, comparatively innocent, he rambled on the sunny hills of old England, played and did mischief with comrades, formed friendships and fought battles, and knew what it was to experience good impulses, understood the joy of giving way to these, as well as the depression consequent on resisting them, and recalled the time when he regarded his mother as the supreme judge in every case of difficulty, the only comforter in every time of sorrow. At this point his spirit groveled like a crushed worm in the stagnant pool of his despair, for he had no hope. He had sinned every opportunity away. He had defied God and man, and nothing was left to him, apparently, save a fearful looking for of judgment. As he bent over the pool, he saw his own distorted visage, dimly reflected therein, and the thought occurred, Why not end it all at once? 5 minutes at the utmost, and all will be over. The pirate was a physically brave man beyond his fellows. He had courage to carry the idea into effect, but after death, the judgment. Where had he heard those words? They were strange to him, but they were not new. Those who are trained in the knowledge of God's word are not, as a general rule, moved in an extraordinary degree by quotations from it. It is often otherwise with those who have had little of it instilled into them in youth and none in later years. That which may seem to be a Christian, but a familiar part of the old, old story, sometimes becomes to hundreds and thousands of human beings a startling revelation. It was so to the pirate on this occasion. The idea of judgment took such a hold of him that he shrank from death with far more fear than he ever had, with courage, faced it in days gone by. Trembling, terrified, abject, he sat there, incapable of consecutive thought or intelligent action. At last, the gloom which had been slowly deepening over the swamp sank into absolute blackness, and the chills of night, which were particularly sharp in such places, began to tell upon him. But he did not dare to move, lest he should fall into the swamp. Slowly he extended himself on the root, wound his arms and fingers convulsively among leaves and branches, and held on like a drowning man. An ague fit seemed to have seized him, for he trembled violently in every limb, and as his exhausted spirit was about to lose itself in sleep, or, as it seemed to him, in death, he gave vent to a subdued cry, "God be merciful to me, a sinner!" Rest, such as it was, refreshed the pirate, and when the gray dawn, struggling through the dense foliage, awoke him, he rose up with a feeling of submissiveness which seemed, somehow, to restore his energy. He was without purpose, however, for he knew nothing of his surroundings, and, of course, could form no idea of what was best to be done. In these circumstances he rose with a strange sensation of helplessness, and wandered straight before him. And, oh, how beautiful were the scenes presented to his vision! Everything in this world is relative. That which is hideous at one time is lovely at another. In the night, the evening, or at the gray dawn, the swamp was indeed dismal in the extreme. But when the morning advanced towards noon, all that was changed, as if magically, by the action of the sun. Black repulsive waters reflected patches of the bright blue sky, and every leaf and spray and parasite and tendril that grew in the world above was faithfully mirrored in the world below. Vistas of gnarled roots and graceful stems and drooping boughs were seen on right and left, before and behind, extending as if into infinite space, while innumerable insects engaged in the business of their brief existence were filling the region with miniature melodies. But Richard Roscoe saw it not. At least it made no sensible impression on him. His mental retina was capable of receiving only two pictures, the concentrated accumulation of past sin, the terrible anticipation of future retribution. Between these two, present danger and suffering were well nigh forgotten. Towards noon, however, the sense of hunger began to oppress him. He allayed it with a few wild berries. Then fatigue began to tell, for walking from root to root, sometimes on short stretches of solid land, sometimes over soft mud, often knee-deep in water, was very exhausting. At last he came to what appeared to be the end of the swamp, and here he discovered a small patch of cultivated ground. The discovery awoke him to the necessity of caution, but he was awakened too late, for already had one of the Rattuan natives observed him advancing out of the swamp. Instantly he gave the alarm that a white face was approaching. Of course, the appearance of one suggested a scout and the speedy approach of a host. Horrified to see a supposed enemy come from a region which they had hitherto deemed their sure refuge, the few natives who dwelt there flew to arms and ran to meet the advancing foe. The pirate was not just then in a mood to resist. He had no weapon and no spirit left. He therefore suffered himself to be taken prisoner without a struggle, satisfied apparently to know that the madman was not one of those into whose hands he had fallen. Great was the rejoicing among the Rattruans when the prisoner was brought in, for they were still smarting under the humiliation of their defeat, and knew well that their discomfiture had been largely owing to the influence of white faces. True, they did not fall into the mistake of supposing that Roscoe was the awful giant who had chased and belabored them so unmercifully with a long stake, but they at once concluded that he was a comrade of Zeppa, perhaps one of a band who had joined their foes. Besides, whether he was a comrade or not was a matter of small moment. Sufficient for them that his face was white, that he belonged to a race which, in the person of Zeppa, had wrought them evil, and that he was now in their power. Of course, the Rattruans had not, during all these years, remained in ignorance of the existence of Zeppa. They had heard of his dwelling in the mountain soon after he had visited the village of their enemies, and had also become aware of the fact that the white man was a madman and a giant. But more than this they did not know, because of their feud preventing interchange of visits or of news between the tribes. Their imaginations, therefore, having full swing, had clothed Zeppa in some of the supposed attributes of a demigod. These attributes, however, the same imaginations quickly exchanged for those of a demi-devil, when at last they saw Zeppa in the flesh, and were put to flight by him. His size, indeed, had rather fallen short of their expectation, for 60 feet had been the average estimate, but his fury and aspect had come quite up to the mark, and the fact that not a man of the tribe had dared to stand before him was sufficient to convince a set of superstitious savages that he was a real devil in human guise. To have secured one of his minor comrades, therefore, was a splendid and unlooked-for piece of good fortune, which they resolved to make the most of by burning the pirate alive. Little did the wretched man think, when they conducted him to a hut in the middle of their village and supplied him with meat and drink, that this was a preliminary ceremony to the terrible end they proposed to make of him. It is true he did not feel easy in his mind, for, despite this touch of hospitality, his captors regarded him with looks of undisguised hatred. There was something of the feline spirit in these Rattruan savages. As the cat plays with the mouse before killing it, so did they amuse themselves with the pirate before putting him to the final torture, which was to terminate his life. And well was it for Roscoe that they did so, for the delay thus caused was the means of saving his life, though he did not come out of the dread ordeal scatheless. They began with a dance, a war dance, it is to be presumed. At all events, it involved the flourishing of clubs and spears, the formation of hideous faces, and the perpetuation of frightful grimaces, with bounds and yells enough to warrant the conclusion that the dance was not one of peace. Richard Roscoe formed the center of that dance, the sun, as it were, of the system round which the dusky host revolved. But he did not join in the celebration, for he was bound firmly to a stake set up in the ground, and could not move hand or foot. At first the warriors of the tribe moved round the pirate in a circle, stamping time slowly with their feet, while the women and children stood in a larger circle, making time with hands and voices. Presently the dance grew more furious, and ultimately attained to a pitch of wild violence which is quite indescribable. At the height of the paroxysm, a warrior would ever and anon dart out from the circle with whirling club and bring it down as if on the prisoner's skull, but would turn it aside so deftly that it just grazed his ear and fell with a dull thud on the ground. Other warriors made at him with their spears, which they thrust with lightning speed at his naked breast, but checked them just as they touched the skin. Two or three of these last were so inexpert that they pierced the skin slightly, and blood began to trickle down. But these clumsy warriors were instantly kicked from the circle of dancers, and compelled to take their place among the women and children. When they had exhausted themselves with the dance, the warriors sat down to feast upon viands, which had, in the meanwhile, been preparing for them, and while they feasted they taunted their prisoner with cowardice, and told him in graphic language of the horrors that yet awaited him. Fortunately for the miserable man, who was left bound to the stake during the feast, he did not understand a word of what was said. He had been stripped of all his clothing save a pair of short breeches, reaching a little below the knee, and his naked feet rested on a curious piece of basket-work. This last would have been too slight to bear his weight if he had not been almost suspended by the cords that bound him to the stake. Roscoe was very pale. He felt that his doom was fixed, but his native courage did not forsake him. He braced himself to meet his fate like a man, and resolved to shut his eyes when next they began to dance round him, so that he should not shrink from the blow or thrust, which he felt sure would ere long end his ill-spent life. But the time seemed to him terribly long, and while he hung there his mind began to recall the gloomy past. Perhaps it was a refinement of cruelty on the part of the savages that they gave him time to think, so that his courage might be reduced or overcome. If so, they were mistaken in their plan. The pirate showed no unusual sign of fear. Once he attempted to pray, but he found that almost impossible. Wearied at length with waiting, the savages arose, and began to put faggots and their combustibles under the wicker basket on which the pirate stood. Then, indeed, was Roscoe's courage tried nearly to the uttermost, and when he saw the fire actually applied, he uttered a cry of, "Help! Help!" so loud and terrible that his enemies fell back for a moment as if appalled. And help came, from a quarter that Roscoe little expected. But to explain this we must return to Zeppa. We have said that he gave up the chase of the pirate under the impression that the whole affair was a dream. But on returning to his cave, he found that he could not rest. Old associations and memories had been too violently aroused, and after spending a sleepless night he rose up, determined to resume the chase which he had abandoned. He returned to the spot where he had lost sight of his enemy in the swamp, and after a brief examination of the place, advanced in as straight a line as he could through the tangled and interlacing boughs. Naturally, he followed the trail of the pirate, for the difficulties or peculiar formations of the ground which had influenced the latter in his course also affected Zeppa much in the same way. Thus it came to pass that when the Raturans were about to burn their prisoner alive, the madman was close to their village. But Zeppa did not think of the Raturans. He had never seen or heard of them, except on the occasion of their attack on the mountain men. His sole desire was to be revenged on the slayer of his boy. And even in this matter, the poor maniac was still greatly perplexed, for his Christian principles and his naturally gentle spirit forbade revenge on the one hand, while on the other a sense of justice told him that murder should not go unpunished, or the murderer remain at large, so that it required the absolute sight of Roscoe before his eyes to rouse him to the pitch of fury necessary to hold him to the execution of his purpose. It was while he was advancing slowly and puzzling his brain over these considerations that Roscoe's cry for help rang out. Zeppa recognized the voice, and a dark frown settled on his countenance as he stopped to listen. Then an appalling yell filled his ears. It was repeated again and again as the kindling flames licked round the pirate's naked feet, causing him to writhe in mortal agony. Instantly Zeppa was stirred to action. He replied with a tremendous shout. Well did the Raturans know that shout. With caught breath and blanched faces, they turned towards the direction whence it came, and they saw the madman bounding toward them with streaming locks and glaring eyes. A single look sufficed. The entire population of the village turned and fled. Next moment, Zeppa rushed up to the stake and kicked the firebrands from beneath the poor victim, who was by that time almost insensible from agony and smoke. Drawing his knife, Zeppa cut the cords, and lifting the pirate in his arms, laid him on the ground. The madman was terribly excited. He had been drenched from frequent immersions in the swamp, besides being much exhausted by his long and difficult walk, or rather scramble, after a sleepless night, and this sudden meeting with his worst enemy in such awful circumstances seemed to have produced an access of insanity, so that the pirate felt uncertain whether he had not been delivered from a horrible fate to fall into one perhaps not less terrible. As he lay there on his back, scorched, tormented with thirst, and helpless, he watched with fearful anxiety each motion of the madman. For some moments Zeppa seemed undecided. He stood with heaving chest, expanding nostrils, and flaring eyes, gazing after the flying crew of natives. Then he turned sharply on the unhappy man who lay at his feet. "Get up," he said fiercely, "and follow me." "I cannot get up, Zeppa," replied the pirate in a faint voice. "Don't you see my feet are burnt? God help me." He ended with a deep groan, and the ferocity at once left Zeppa's countenance, but the wild light did not leave his eyes, nor did he become less excited in his actions. "Come, I will carry you," he said. Stooping down quickly, he raised the pirate in his arms as if he had been a child, and bore him away. Avoiding the swamp, he proceeded in the direction of the mountain by another route, a route which ran so near to Angolo's village that the Raturans never ventured to use it. He passed the village without having been observed, and began to toil slowly up the steep ascent, panting as he went, for his mighty strength had been overtaxed and his helpless burden was heavy. "Lay me down and rest yourself," said Roscoe with a groan that he could not suppress, for his scorched lower limbs caused him unutterable anguish, and beads of perspiration stood upon his brow, while a deadly pallor overspread his face. Zeppa spoke no word in reply. He did, indeed, look at the speaker once, uneasily, but took no notice of his request. Thus, clasping his enemy to his breast, he ascended the steep hill, struggling and stumbling upwards, as if with some fixed and stern purpose in view, until at last he gained the shelter of his mountain cave. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of The Madman and the Pirate. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read and recorded by Betsy Bush, in Marquette, Michigan, August 2007. The Madman and the Pirate, by R. M. Ballantyne. Chapter 10. We change the scene once more, and transport our readers over the ocean waves to a noble ship which is breasting those waves right gallantly. It is H.M.S. Furious. In a retired part of the ship's cabin there are two savage nobles who do not take things quite as gallantly as the ship herself. These are our friends Tomeo and Buchi of Ratinga. Each is seated on the cabin floor with his back against the bulkhead, an expression of woe-begone desolation on his visage, his black legs apart, and a ship's bucket between them. It were bad taste to be too particular as to details here. On quitting Ratinga, Tomeo and his brother chief had said that nothing would rejoice their hearts so much as to go to sea. Their wish was gratified, and not long afterwards they said that nothing could rejoice their hearts so much as to get back to land. Such is the contradictoriness of human nature. There was a stiffish breeze blowing, as one of the man-of-war's men expressed it, and a nasty sea on. He did not say on what. There must have been something nasty also on Tomeo's stomach, from the violent way in which he sought to get rid of it at times, without success. "Oh, Buchi, my brother," said Tomeo, of course in his native tongue, "many years have passed over my head. A few white streaks begin to—" He paused abruptly and eyed the bucket, as if it were an intention. "To appear," he continued with a short sigh. "Also I have seen many wars and suffered much from many wounds as you—ha! You know, Buchi, my brother, but of all the—" He became silent again, suddenly. "Why does my brother pause?" asked Buchi, in a meek voice, as of one who had suffered severely in life's pilgrimage. There was no occasion for Tomeo to offer a verbal reply. After a time Buchi raised his head and wiped his eyes, in which were many tears, but not of sorrow. "Tomeo," said he, Was it worth our while to forsake wives and children, and church and hymns, and taro fields and home for this? We did not leave for this, replied Tomeo, with acerbity, for he experienced a temporary sensation of feeling better at the moment. We left all for the sake of assisting our friends in there. It comes, it— He said no more, and both chiefs relapsed into silence, gazing the while at the buckets with undue interest. They were interrupted by the sudden entrance of Ebony. "Come, you yaller-cheeked chiefs! Yous die if you no make a heffort. Come on deck, breathe de fresh air, git up a appetite, go in for salt pork, plum duff, and lobscouse, and you'll get well before you can say Jack Robinson." Tomeo and Buchi looked up at the jovial negro and smiled. Imbecile smiles they were. "We cannot move," said Tomeo and Buchi together, "because we—" Together they ceased giving the reason. It was not necessary. "Oh, dear," said Ebony, opening his great eyes to their widest. "You no can lib long at dat rate. Better die on deck if you must die. More easy for you to breathe up dere, and more comfortable to throw you overboard when you've got it over." With this cheering remark, the worthy negro, seizing the chiefs each by a hand, half constrained, half assisted to rise, and helped them to stagger to the quarter-deck, where they were greeted by Orlando, Captain Fitzgerald, Waronga, and the missionary.
"Come, that's right," cried the captain, shaking the two melancholy chiefs by the hand. "Glad to see you plucking up courage. Tell them, Mr. Zeppa, that we shall probably be at Sugarloaf Island tomorrow or next day."
The two unfortunates were visibly cheered by the assurance. To do them justice, they were not quite given way to seasickness until then, for the weather had been moderately calm, but the nasty sea and stiff breeze had proved too much for them. "Are you sure we shall find the island so soon?" asked Orlando of the captain in a low, earnest tone, for the poor youth's excitement and anxiety deepened as they drew near to the place where his father might possibly be found. At the same time a strange, shrinking dread of what they might find made him almost wish for delay.
"I'm not sure, of course," returned the captain, "but if my information is correct, there is every probability that we shall find it tomorrow."
"I hopes we shall," remarked Waronga. "It would be a grand blessing if the Lord will give us the island and your father in same day."
"Most too good to be true," observed Ebony, who was a privileged individual on board, owing very much to his good-humored eccentricity. "But surely you not specs de niggers to tumble down at you's feet all at once, Massa Waronga?"
"Oh no, not at once. The day of miracle have passed," returned the missionary. "We must use the means, and then has we not the promise that our work shall not be in vain?"
Next day, about noon, the Sugarloaf Mountain rose out of the sea like a great pillar of hope to Orlando, as well as to the missionary. Captain Fitzgerald sailed close in, sweeping the mountainside with his telescope as he advanced until close under the cliffs, when he lay to and held a consultation with his passengers.
"I see no habitations of any kind," he said, "nor any sign of the presence of man, but I have heard that the native villages lie at the lower side of the island. Now the question is whether would it suit your purposes best to land an armed party here and cross over to the villages, or to sail round the island, drop anchor in the most convenient bay, and land a party there."
Orlando, to whom this was more directly addressed, turned to the missionary.
"What think you, Waronga? You know native thought and feeling best."
"I would not land armed a party at all," answered Waronga, "but Captain Fitzgerald knows his own business most, what he thinks."
"My business and yours are so mingled," returned the captain, "that I look to you for advice. My chief duty is to obtain information as to the whereabouts of the pirate vessel, and I expect that such information will be got more readily through you, Waronga, than anyone else. For besides being able to speak the native language, you can probably approach the savages more easily than I can."
"They are not savages," returned Waronga quietly. "They are God's ignorant children. I have seen worse men than South Sea Islanders with white faces and soft clothing, who had not the excuse of ignorance.
"Nay, my good sir," said the captain, "we will not quarrel about terms. Whatever else these ignorant children may be, I know that they are brave and warlike, and I shall gladly listen to your advice as to landing."
"If you wish to go to them in peace, do not go to them with arms," said Waranga.
"Surely you would not advise me to send an unarmed party among armed children," returned the captain, with a look of surprise, while Orlando regarded his friend with mingled amusement and curiosity.
"No, you best send no party at all. Just go round the island, put down anchor, and leave the rest to me."
"But what do you propose to do?" asked the captain.
"Swim to shore with Bible."
Orlando laughed, for he now understood the missionary's plan, and in a few words described the method by which Waranga had subdued the natives of Ratinga. "You see, by this plan," he continued, "nothing is presented to the natives which they will be tempted to steal, and if they are very warlike or fierce, Waranga's refusal to fight reduces them to a state of quiet readiness to hear, which is all that we want. Waranga's tongue does the rest."
"With God's Holy Spirit and the Word," interposed the missionary.
"True, that is understood," said Orlando.
"That is not always understood," returned Waranga.
"The plan does not seem to me a very good one," said Captain Fitzgerald thoughtfully. "I can have no doubt that it has succeeded in time past, and may probably succeed again. But you cannot expect that the natives, even if disposed to be peaceful, will accept your message at once. It may take weeks, perhaps months, before you get them to believe the gospel, so as to permit of my men going ashore unarmed, and in the meantime, while you are engaged in this effort, what am I to be doing?"
"Wait God's time," answered Waranga simply.
"But time presses. The pirate vessel, wherever it may be, is escaping me," said the captain, unable to repress a smile. "However, I will, at all events, let you make the trial and await the result, reminding you, however, that you will run considerable risk, and that you must be prepared to accept the consequences of your rather reckless proceedings."
"I hope, Waranga," said Orlando, when the captain left them to give orders as to the course of the ship, "that you will let me share this risk with you."
"It will be easier not. You are a strong man, and sometimes fierce to behold. They will want to fight you. Then up go your blood, and you will want to fight them."
"No, indeed, I won't," said Orlando earnestly. "I will promise to go in the spirit of a missionary. You know how anxious I am to get news of my dear father. How could you expect me to remain idle on board this vessel when my soul is so troubled? You may depend on me, Waranga. I will do exactly as you bid me, and will place myself peaceably in the power of natives, leaving the result, as you advise, to God." The young man's tone was so earnest, and withal so humble, that Waranga could not help acceding to his request.
"Well, well," said Captain Fitzgerald, when he heard of it, "you seem both to be bent on making martyrs of yourselves, but I will offer no opposition. All I can say is that I shall have my guns in readiness, and if I see anything like foul play, I'll bombard the place, and land an armed force to do what I can for you."
Soon the frigate came in sight of Ongoloo's village, ran close in, brought up in a sheltered bay, and lowered a boat while the natives crowded the beach in vast numbers, uttering fierce cries, brandishing clubs and spears, and making other warlike demonstrations, for these poor people had been more than once visited by so-called merchant ships, the crews of which had carried off some of them by force.
"We will not let a living man touch our shore," said Ongoloo to Waputa,
who chanced to be near his leader when he marshaled his men.
"Oh, yes, we will, chief," replied the brown humorist. "We will let some of them touch it, and then we will take them up carefully and have them baked. A long pig supper will do us good. The rest of them we will drive back to their big canoe."
By the term long pig, Waputa referred to the resemblance that a naked white man, when prepared for roasting, bears to an ordinary pig. A grim smile lit up Angulu's swarthy visage as he replied,
"Yes, we will permit a few fat ones to land,
The rest shall die, for white men are thieves. They deceived us last time. They shall never deceive us again." As this remark might have been meant for a covert reference to his own thievish tendencies, Wapoota restrained his somewhat ghastly humor, while the chief continued his arguments for repelling the invaders. Meanwhile, these invaders were getting into the boat.
"What? You're not going without me?" exclaimed Ebony, as one of the sailors thrust him aside from the gangway.
"I fear we are," said Orlando, as he was about to descend the vessel's side. "It was as much as I could do to get Waronga to agree to let me go with him."
"But dis yon nigger can die in a good cause as well as you, massa," said Ebony, in a tone of entreaty so earnest that the men standing near could not help laughing.
"Now then, make haste," sang out the officer in charge of the boat. Orlando descended, and the negro, turning away with a deeply injured expression, walked majestically to the stern to watch the boat. Waronga had prepared himself for the enterprise by stripping off every article of clothing save a linen cloth round his loins, and he carried nothing whatever with him except a small copy of God's Word printed in the language of the islanders. This, as the boat drew near to shore, he fastened on his head, among the bushy curls of his crisp black hair, as in a nest. Orlando had clothed himself in a pair of patched old canvas trousers and a much-worn, unattractive cotton shirt.
"Stop now," said the missionary, when the boat was about 500 or 600 yards from the beach. "Are you ready?"
"Ready," said Orlando.
"Then come."
He dropped quietly over the side and swam towards the shore. Orlando, following his example, was alongside of him in a few seconds. Both men were expert and rapid swimmers. The natives watched them in absolute silence and open-mouthed surprise. A few minutes sufficed to carry the swimmers to the beach.
"Have your rifles handy, lads," said the officer in charge of the boat to his men.
"Stand by," said the captain of the Furious to the men at the guns. But these precautions were unnecessary, for when the swimmers landed and walked up the beach, they were seen by the men-of-war's men to shake hands with the chief of the savages, and after that appeared to be a brief palaver to rub noses with him. Then the entire host turned and led the visitors toward the village. With a heart almost bursting with the combined efforts of disappointment, humiliation, and grief, poor Ebony stood at the stern of the man-of-war with arms crossed upon his brawny chest, and his great eyes swimming in irrepressible tears, a monstrous bead of which would every now and then overflow its banks and roll down his sable cheeks. Suddenly the heart-stricken negro clasped his hands together, bowed his head, and dropped into the sea. The captain, who had seen him take the plunge, leaped to the stern and saw him rise from the water, blow like a grampus, and strike out for land with the steady vigor of a gigantic frog.
"Pick him up!" shouted the captain to the boat, which was by that time returning to the ship.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
was the prompt reply. The boat was made straight for the negro, and he for it. Neither diverged from the straight course.
"Two of you in the bow there, get ready to haul him in," said the officer.
Two sturdy soldiers drew in their oars, got up, and leaned over the bow with outstretched arms. Ebony looked at them, bestowed on them a tremendous grin, and went down with the oily ease of a northern seal. When next seen, he was full 100 yards astern of the boat, still heading steadily for the shore.
"Let him go!" shouted the captain.
"Aye, aye, sir," replied the obedient officer.
And Ebony went. Meanwhile, our missionary, having told the wondering savages that he brought them good news, was conducted with his companion to Ongoloo's hut. But it was plain that the good news referred to, and even Waronga himself, had not nearly so great an effect on them as the sight of Orlando, at whom they gazed with an expression half of fear and half of awe, which surprised him exceedingly.
"Your story is not new to us," said Ongoloo, addressing the missionary, but gazing at Orlando. "It comes to us like an old song."
"How so?" exclaimed Waronga. "Has anyone been here before with the grand and sweet story of Jesus and his love?"
The reply of the savage chief was strangely anticipated and checked at that moment by a burst of childish voices singing one of the beautiful hymns with which the inhabitants of Ratinga had long been familiar.
As the voices swelled in a chorus, which distance softened into fairy-like strains, the missionary and his companions sat entranced and bewildered, while the natives looked pleased and appeased to enjoy their perplexity.
"Our little ones," said Ongoloo, after a few minutes' pause, "are amusing themselves with singing. They often do that."
As he spoke, the party were startled and surprised by the sudden appearance of Ebony, who quietly stalked into the circle and seated himself beside the missionary with the guilty yet defiant air of a man who knows that he has done wrong, but is resolved at all hazards to have his way. Considering the turn that affairs had taken, neither Orlando nor Waranga were sorry to see him.
"This is a friend," said the latter in explanation, laying his hand on the negro's shoulder. "But tell me, chief, we are impatient for to know where learned you that song."
"From one who is mad," replied the chief, still gazing earnestly at Orlando.
"Mad?" repeated the youth, starting up and trembling with excitement. "How know you that? Where is he? Ask him, Waranga."
The explanation that followed left no doubt on Orlando's mind that his father was bereft of reason and wandering in the neighboring mountain. If there had been any doubt, it would have been swept away by the chief, who quietly said,
"The madman is your father."
"How does he know that, Waranga?"
"I know because there is no difference between you, except years, and—"
He did not finish the sentence, but touched his forehead solemnly with his finger.
"Does he dwell alone in the mountains?" asked Orlando. "Yes, alone. He lets no one approach him," answered Ongoloo.
"Now, Waranga," said Orlando, "our prayers have been heard, and at least partly answered, but we must proceed with caution. You must return on board and tell Captain Fitzgerald that I go to search for my father alone."
"Wid de help ob dis yar nigger," interposed Ebony.
"Tell him on no account to send men in search of me," continued Orlando, paying no attention to the interruption, "and in the meantime you know how to explain my purpose to the natives. Adieu." Rising quickly, he left the assembly, and, followed modestly but closely by the unconquerable negro, set off with rapid strides towards the mountains. End of chapter 10.
Chapter 11 of The Madman and the Pirate. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Madman and the Pirate by R. M. Ballantyne. Chapter 11. When Zeppa, as related in a previous chapter, staggered up the mountainside with Richard Rosco in his arms, his great strength was all but exhausted, and it was with the utmost difficulty that he succeeded at last, before nightfall, in laying his burden on the couch in his cave. Then, for the first time, he seemed to have difficulty in deciding what to do. Now, at last, the pirate was in his power. He could do to him what he pleased. As he thought thus, he turned a look of fierce indignation upon him. But even as he gazed, the look faded, and was replaced by one of pity, for he could not help seeing that the wretched man was suffering intolerable anguish, though no murmur escaped from his tightly compressed lips.
"Slay me, in God's name, kill me at once, Zeppa," he gasped, "and put me out of my torment." "Poor man, poor Rosco," returned the madman in a gentle voice, "I thought to have punished thee, but God wills it otherwise." He said no more, but rose hastily and went into the bush. Returning in a few moments with a bundle of herbs, he gathered some sticks and kindled a fire. A large earthenware pot stood close to the side of the cave's entrance, a clumsy thing made by himself of some sort of clay. This he filled with water, put the herbs in, and set it on the fire. Soon he had a poultice spread on a broad leaf, which, when it was cold, he applied to one of the pirate's dreadfully burnt feet. Then he spread another poultice, with which he treated the other foot. What the remedy was that Zeppa made use of on this occasion is best known to himself. We can throw no light on the subject. Neither can we say whether the application was or was not in accordance with the practice of the faculty, but certain it is that Rosco's sufferings were immediately assuaged, and he soon fell into a tranquil sleep. Not so the madman, who watched by his couch. Poor Zeppa's physical sufferings and exertion had proved too much for him. The strain on his shattered nerves had been too severe, and a burning fever was now raging within him, so that the delirium consequent on disease began to mingle, so to speak, with his insanity. He felt that something unusual was going on within him. He tried to restrain himself and chain down his wandering, surging thoughts, but the more he sought to hold himself down, the more did a demon, who seemed to have been specially appointed for the purpose, cast his mental fastenings adrift. At last he took it into his head that the slumbering pirate had bewitched him. As this idea gained ground and the internal fires increased, the old ideas of revenge returned, and he drew the knife which hung at his belt, gazing furtively at the sleeper as he did so. But the better nature within the man maintained a fierce conflict with the worse. "He murdered my son, my darling Orly," murmured the madman, as he felt the keen edge and point of his knife, and crept towards the sleeper, while a fitful flicker of the dying fire betrayed the awful light that seemed to blaze in his eyes. "He carried me from my home. He left Marie to die in hopeless grief. Ha, 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 oh God, keep me back from this." The noise awoke Roscoe, who sat up and gazed at Zeppa in horror, for he saw at a glance that a fit of his madness must have seized him. "Zeppa!" he exclaimed, raising himself with difficulty on both hands, and gazing sternly in the madman's face. "Ha!" exclaimed the latter, suddenly throwing his knife on the ground within Roscoe's reach. "See, I scorn to take advantage of your unarmed condition. Take that and defend yourself. I will content myself with this." He caught up the heavy staff with which he was in the habit of carrying with him in his mountain rambles. At the same instant Roscoe seized the knife and flung it far into the bush. "See, I am still unarmed," he said. "True, but you are not the less guilty, Roscoe, and you must die. It is my duty to kill you." He advanced with the staff upraised. "Stay, let us consider before you strike. Are you not a self-appointed executioner?" The question was well put. The madman lowered the staff to consider. Instantly the pirate made a plunge at it and caught it. Zeppa strove to wrench it from his grasp, but the pirate felt that his life might depend on his retaining hold, and, in his extremity, was endued with almost supernatural strength. In the fierce struggles that ensued, the embers of the fire were scattered, and the spot reduced to almost total darkness. During the unequal conflict, the pirate, who could only get upon his knees, was swept and hurled from side to side, but still he grasped the staff with vice-like power to his breast. Even in that fearful moment, the idea, which had already occurred to him, of humouring his antagonist, gained force. He suddenly loosed his hold. Zeppa staggered backwards, recovered himself, sprang forward, and aimed a fearful blow at his adversary, who suddenly fell flat down. The staff passed harmlessly over him, and was shattered to pieces on the side of the cave. "Ha, ha!" laughed the pirate lightly, as he sat up again. "You see, Zeppa, that providence is against you. How else could I, a helpless cripple, have held my own against you? And see, the very weapon you meant to use is broken to pieces. Come now, delay this execution for a little, and let us talk together about this death which you think is due. There is much to be said about death, you know, and I should like to get to understand it better before I experience it." "There is reason in that, Roscoe," said Zeppa, sitting down on the ground by the side of the pirate, and leaning his back against the rock. "You have much need to consider death, for after death comes the judgment, and none of us can escape that." "True, Zeppa, and I should not like to face that just now, for I am not fit to die, although, as you truly say, I deserve death. I have no hesitation in admitting that," returned the pirate with some bitterness. "I deserve to die, body and soul, and after all, I don't see why I should seek so earnestly to delay the righteous doom." "Right, Roscoe, right. "You talk sense now. The doom is well deserved. Why, then, try to prevent me any longer from inflicting it when you know it is my duty to do so?" "Because," continued the pirate, who felt that to maintain the conflict, even with words, was too much for his exhausted strength, "because I have heard that God is merciful." "Merciful," echoed Zeppa. "Of course he is. Have you not heard that his mercy is so great that he has provided a way of escape for sinners through faith in his own dear son?" "It does not, however, seem to be a way of escape for me," said the pirate, letting himself sink back on his couch with a weary sigh. Yes, it is, exclaimed Zeppa earnestly, as he got upon the familiar theme. "The offer is to the chief of sinners. Whosoever will, turn ye, for why will ye die?"
"Tell me about it," said Roscoe faintly, as the other paused.
Zeppa had delayed a moment in order to think, for his disordered mind had been turned into a much-loved channel, that of preaching the gospel to inquiring sinners. For many years he had been training himself in the knowledge of the Scriptures, and, being possessed of a good memory, he had got large portions of it by heart. Gathering together the embers of the scattered fire, he sat down again, and, gazing thoughtfully at the flickering flames, began to point out the way of salvation to the pirate. Sleep, irresistible sleep, gradually overcame the latter. Still the former went on, repeating long passages of God's word. At last he put a question, and not receiving an answer, looked earnestly into the face of his enemy. "Ah, poor man, he sleeps. God cannot wish me to slay him until I have made him understand the gospel. I will delay till tomorrow." Before the morrow came, Zeppa had wandered forth among the cliffs and gorges of his wild home, with the ever-increasing fires of fever raging in his veins. Sometimes his madness took the form of wildest fury, and grasping some bush or sapling that might chance to be near, he would struggle with it as with a fiend until utter exhaustion caused him to fall prostrate on the ground, where he would lie until partial rest and internal fire gave him strength again to rise. At other times he would run up and down the hills like a greyhound, bounding from rock to rock and across chasms where one false step would have sent him headlong to destruction. Frequently he ran down to the beach and plunged into the sea, where he would swim about aimlessly until exhaustion sent him to the shore, where he would fall down, as at other times, and rest, if such repose could be so styled. Thus he continued fighting for his life for several days. During that time Richard Roscoe lay in the cave almost starving. At first he had found several coconuts, the hard shells of which had been broken by Zeppa, and appeased his hunger with these, but when they were consumed he sought about the cave for food in vain. Fortunately he found a large earthenware pot, evidently a homemade one, nearly full of water, so that he was spared the agony of thirst as well as hunger. When he had scraped the shells of the coconuts perfectly clean, the pirate tried to crawl forth on hands and knees to search for food, his feet being in such a state that it was not possible for him to stand, much less to walk. But Zeppa had long ago cleared away all the wild fruits that grew in the neighborhood of his cave, so that he found nothing save a few wild berries. Still in his condition, even these were of the utmost value. They helped to keep him alive. Another night passed, and the day came. He crept forth once more, but was so weakened by suffering and want that he could not extend his explorations so far as before, and was compelled to return without having tasted a mouthful. Taking a long draught of water, he lay down, as he firmly believed, to die. And as he lay there, his life rose up before him as an avenging angel, and the image of his dead mother returned with reproachful yet an appealing look in her eyes. He tried to banish the one and to turn his thoughts from the other, but failed, and at last in an agony of remorse shouted the single word, "Guilty." It seemed as if the cry had called Zeppa from his world of spirits, to which Roscoe believed he had fled. For a few minutes afterwards the madman approached his mountain home,
with the blood still boiling in his veins. Apparently he had forgotten all about the pirate, for he was startled on beholding him.
"What, still here? I thought I had killed you."
"I wish you had, Zeppa. It would have been more merciful than leaving me to die of hunger here."
"Are you prepared to die now?"
"Yes, but for God's sake give me something to eat first. After that I care not what you do to me."
"Miserable man, death is sufficient for you. I have neither command nor desire to torture. You shall have food immediately."
So saying, Zeppa re-entered the bush. In less than half an hour he returned with several coconuts and other fruits, of which Rosco partook with an avidity that told its own tale.
"Now," said Zeppa, rising, when Rosco had finished, "have you had enough?"
"No," said the pirate quickly, "not half enough. Go like a good fellow and fetch me more." Zeppa rose at once and went away. While he was gone, the fear of being murdered again took possession of Rosco. He felt that his last hour was approaching, and, in order to avoid his doom if possible, crawled away among the bushes and tried to hide himself. He was terribly weak, however, and had not got 50 yards away when he fell down utterly exhausted. He heard Zeppa return to the cave, and listened with beating heart.
"Hallo! Where are you?"
cried the madman. Then, receiving no answer, he burst into a long, loud fit of laughter, which seemed to freeze the marrow in the pirate's bones.
"Ha, ha!" he shouted again and again. "I knew you were a dream. I felt sure of it. Ha, ha! And now this proves it. And I am glad you were a dream, for I did not want to kill you, Rosco, though I thought it my duty to do so. It was a dream. Thank God, it was all a dream."
Zeppa did not end again with wild laughter, but betook himself to earnest, importunate prayer, during which Rosco crept, by slow degrees, further and further away, until he could no longer hear the sound of his enemy's voice. Now, it was while this latter scene had been enacting that Orlando and the faithful negro set out on their search into the mountain. At first they did not speak, and Ebony, not feeling sure how his young master relished his company, kept discreetly a pace or two in rear. After they had crossed the plain, however, and begun to scale the steep sides of the hills, his tendency towards conversation could not be restrained.
"Does you tink, Massa Orley, that hims be you fader?"
"I think so, Ebony, indeed. I feel almost sure of it." Thus encouraged, the negro ran up alongside.
"And does you tink him's mad?"
"I hope not, I pray not, but I fear that he—"
"Him's got little out of sorts,"
said the sympathetic Ebony, suggesting a milder state of things. As Orlando did not appear to derive much consolation from the suggestion, Ebony held his tongue for a few minutes. Presently his attention was attracted to a sound in the underwood near them.
"Hist, Massa Orley, I hear something."
"So do I, Ebony," said the youth, pausing for a moment to listen. "It must be some sort of bird, for there can be no wild animals left by the natives in so small an island." As he spoke, something like a low moan was heard. The negro's mouth opened, and the whites of his great eyes seemed to dilate.
"If it am a bird, massa, him's got mouse awful voice. Must have cotched a dreadful cold."
The groan was repeated as he spoke, and immediately after they observed a large, sluggish-looking animal advancing through the underwood.
"What a pity we's not got a gun," whispered Ebony. "If we's only had a spear or a pitchfork, it's better than nothing."
"Lucky that you have nothing of the sort, else you'd commit murder," said Orlando, advancing. "Don't you see, it is a man." The supposed animal started as the youth spoke, and rose on his knees with a terribly haggard and anxious look.
"Richard Rosco!" exclaimed Orley, who recognized the pirate at the first glance.
But Rosco did not reply. He too had recognized Orley, despite the change in his size and appearance, and believed him to be a visitant from the other world, an idea which was fostered by the further supposition that Ebony was the devil keeping him company. Orlando soon relieved him, however. The aspect of the pirate so haggard and worn out as he crawled on his hands and knees, was so dreadful that a flood of pity rushed into his bosom. "My poor fellow," he said, going forward and laying his hand gently on his shoulder, "this is indeed a most unexpected, most amazing sight. How came you here?" "Then you were not drowned?" gasped the pirate, instead of answering the question. "No, thank God, I was not drowned," said Orley, with a sad smile. "But again I ask, how came you here?" "Never mind me," said Rosco hurriedly, "but go to your father." "My father, do you know, then, where he is?" cried Orlando, with sudden excitement. "Yes, he is up there, not far off. I have just escaped from him. He is bent on taking my life. He saved me from the savages. He is mad with fever, and stands terribly in need of help." Bewildered beyond expression by these contradictory statements, Orlando made no attempt to understand, but exclaimed, "Can you guide us to him?" "You see," returned the pirate sadly, "I cannot even rise to my feet. The savages were burning me alive when your father came to my rescue. The flesh is dropping from the bones. I cannot help you." "Can you get on my back?" asked Ebony. "You's a good lift, but I's awful strong." "I will try," returned Rosco, "but you will have to protect me from Zeppa if he sees me, for he is bent on taking my life. He thinks you were drowned, as indeed so did I, the time you were thrown overboard without my knowledge. Mind that, without my knowledge. And your father, in his madness, thinks he is commissioned by God to avenge your death. Perhaps when he sees you alive he may change his mind, but there is no depending on one who is delirious with fever. He will probably still be in the cave when we reach it. We will protect you. Get up quickly, and show us the way to the cave." In a moment the stout negro had the pirate on his broad shoulders, and, under his guidance, mounted the slightly marked path that led to Zeppa's retreat. No words were spoken by the way. Orlando was too full of anxious anticipation to speak. The negro was too heavily weighted to care about conversation just then. And Rosco suffered so severely from the rough motions of his black steed that he was fain to purse his lips tightly to prevent a cry of pain. On reaching the neighborhood of the cave, the pirate whispered to Ebony to set him down. "You will come in sight of the place the moment you turn round yonder cliff. It is better that I should remain here till the meeting is over. I hear no sound, but doubtless Zeppa is lying down by this time." The negro set his burden on the ground, and Rosco crept slowly into the bush to hide, while the others hurried forward in the direction pointed out to them. End of chapter 11.
Chapter 12 of The Madman and the Pirate. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Lucy Burgoyne. The Madman and the Pirate by R. M. Ballantyne. Chapter 12. No sooner had Orlando and the negro passed round the cliff to which Rosco had directed them than they beheld a sight which was well calculated to fill them with anxiety and alarm. For there stood Zeppa, panting and wrestling with one of the fiends that were in the habit of assailing him. The fiend, on this occasion, was familiar enough to him, the stout branch of a tree which overhung his cave, but which his delirious brain had transformed into a living foe. No shout or cry issued from the poor man's compressed lips. He engaged in the deadly struggle with that silent resolve of purpose which was natural to him. The disease under which he laboured had probably reached its climax, for he swayed to and fro in his futile efforts to wrench off the limb with a degree of energy that seemed more than human. His partially naked limbs showed the knotted muscles standing out rigidly. His teeth were clenched and exposed. His bloodshot eyes glared. The long, curling and matted hair of his head and beard was flying about in wild disorder, and his labouring chest heaved as if he fiercely, silently and hopelessly struggled. Oh, it was a terrible picture to be presented thus suddenly to the gaze of a loving son. "Stay where you are, Ebony. I must meet him alone," whispered Orlando. Then, hastening forward with outstretched arms, he exclaimed, "Father!" Instantly Zeppa let go his supposed enemy and turned round. The change in his aspect was as wonderful as it was sudden. The old, loving, gentle expression overspread his features, and the wild fire seemed to die out of his eyes as he held out both hands. "Ah, once more, my son," he said, in the tenderest of tones. "Come to me. This is kind of you, Orly, to return so soon again. I had not expected you for a long time. Sit down beside me and lay your head upon my knee. So, I like to have you that way, for I see you better." "Oh, father, dear father," said Orlando, but the words were choked in his throat, and tears welled from his eyes. "Yes, Orly," said Zeppa, with a startled look of joyful surprise, while he turned his head a little to one side, as if listening in expectancy. "Speak again, dear boy, speak again. I have often seen you since you went to the spirit land, but have never heard you speak till today. Speak once more, dear boy." But Orly could not speak. He could only hide his face in his father's bosom and sob aloud. "Nay, don't cry, lad. You never did that before. What do you mean? That is unmanly. Not like my courageous boy was wont to be. And you have grown so much since last I saw you. Why, you've even got a beard. Who ever heard of a bearded man sobbing like a child? And now I look at you closely, I see that you have grown wonderfully tall. It is very strange, but all things seem strange since I came here. Only, in all the many visits you have paid me, I have never seen you change till today. You have always come to me in the old boyish form. Very, very strange. But, Orly, my boy," and here Zeppa's voice became intensely earnest and pleading, "you won't leave me again, will you? Surely they can well spare you from the spirit world for a time, just a little while. It would fill my heart with such joy and gratitude. And I'm your father, Orly. Surely I have a right to you, more right than the angels have, haven't I? And then it would give me such joy if you came back to your dear mother, whom I have not seen for so long, so very long." "I will never leave you, father, never," cried Orlando, throwing his arms round Zeppa's neck and embracing him passionately. "Nah, then, you are going to leave me," cried Zeppa, with sudden alarm, as he clasped Orlando to him with an iron grip. "You always embrace me when you are about to vanish out of my sight. But you shall not escape me this time. I have got you tighter than I ever had you before, and no fiend shall separate us now. No fiend," he repeated in a shout, glaring at a spot in the bushes where Ebony, unable to restrain his feelings, had unwittingly come into sight. Suddenly changing his purpose, Zeppa let go his son and sprung like a tiger on the supposed fiend. Ebony went down before him like a bulrush before the hurricane, but, unlike it, he did not rise again. The madman had pinned him to the earth and was compressing his throat with both hands. It required all the united strength of his son and the negro to loosen his grasp, and even that would not have sufficed had not the terrible flame which had burned so long died out. It seemed to have been suddenly extinguished by this last burst of fury, for Zeppa fell back as helpless as an infant in their hands. Indeed, he lay so still with his eyes closed that Orlando trembled with fear lest he should be dying. "Now, Ebony," said he, taking the negro apart, when they had made the exhausted man as comfortable as possible on his rude couch in the cave, "you run down to the ship and fetch the doctor here without delay. I will be able to manage him easily when alone. Run as you never ran before. Don't let any soul come here except the doctor and yourself. Tell the captain I have found him, through God's mercy, but that he is very ill and must be carefully kept from excitement, and that in the meantime nobody is to disturb us. The doctor will of course fetch physic, and tell him to bring his surgical instrument also, for, if I mistake not, poor Roscoe needs his attention. Do bring up as much in the way of provisions as you can carry, and one or two blankets. And, harkee, make no mention of the pirate to anyone. Away." During the delivery of this message, the negro listened eagerly, and stood quite motionless, like a black statue, with the exception of his glittering eyes. "Yes, massa," he said, at its conclusion, and almost literally vanished from the scene. Orlando then turned to his father. The worn-out man still lay perfectly quiet, with closed eyes, and countenance so pale that the dread of approaching death again seized on the son. The breathing was, however, slow and regular, and what appeared to be a slight degree of moisture lay on the brow. The fact that the sick man slept soon became apparent, and when Orlando had assured himself of this, he arose, left the cave with careful tread, and glided, rather than walked, back to the place where the pirate had been left. There he still lay, apparently much exhausted. "We have found him, thank God," said Orlando, seating himself on a bank, "and I would fain hope that the worst is over, for he sleeps. But, poor fellow, you seem to be in a bad case. Can I do aught to relieve you?" "Nothing," replied Roscoe, with a weary sigh. "I have sent for a surgeon." "A surgeon?" repeated the pirate, with a startled look. "Then there must be a man of war off the coast, for South Sea traders are not used to carry surgeons." "Ah, I forgot. You naturally don't wish to see anyone connected with a man of war. Yes, there is one here. I came in her. But you can see this surgeon without his knowing who or what you are. It will be sufficient for him to know that you are an unfortunate sailor who had fallen into the hands of the savages." "Yes," exclaimed Roscoe, grasping eagerly at the idea, "and that's just what I am. Moreover, I ran away from my ship, but do you not feel it your duty to give me up?" "What I shall feel it my duty to do ultimately is not a matter for present consideration. Just now you require surgical assistance. But how did you come here, and what do you mean by saying that you ran away from your ship?" Roscoe, in reply, gave a brief but connected narrative of his career during the past 3 years, in which he made no attempt to exculpate himself, but, on the contrary, confessed his guilt and admitted his desert of death. "Yet I shrink from death," he said, in conclusion. "Is it not strange that I, who have faced death so often with perfect indifference, should draw back from it now with something like fear. A great writer, replied Orlando, whom my father used to read to me at home, says that conscience makes cowards of us all. And a still greater authority says that the wicked flee when no man pursueth. You are safe here, Roscoe, at all events, for the present, but you must not go near the cave again. Rest where you are, and I will search for some place where you may remain concealed till you are well. I shall return quickly. Leaving the pirate where he lay, Orlando returned to his father, and, finding that he still slept, went off to search for a cave. He soon found a small one in the cliffs, suitable for his purpose. Thither he carried the pirate, laid him tenderly on a couch of branches and leaves, put food and water within his reach, and left him with a feeling of comfort and of contentment at heart that he had not experienced for many years. That night the surgeon of the Furious ascended to the mountain cave. His approach was made known to Orlando, as he watched at the sick man's side, by the appearance of Ebony's great eyes glittering at him over the bushes that encircled the cave's mouth. No wonder that poor Zeppa had mistaken him for a demon. Holding up a finger of caution, Orlando glided towards him, seized his arm, and, after leading him to a safe distance, asked in a low voice, "Well, have you brought the doctor?" "Oh, yes, massa, and I bring Tomio and butcher too." "Didn't I tell you to let no one else come near us?" said Orlando, in a tone of vexation. "Dat's true, massa, but I no kin stop dem. So soon as they hear dat Antonio Zeppa am found, sick in de mountains, dey swore dey must go see him. I say dat you say no. Dey say dey don't care. I say me knock 'em both down. Dey say dey turn me inside bout if I don't hold my tongue. What could dis yere nigger do? Dey's too much for me." So dey followed, and here dey am with de doctor, waiting about 200 yards down, therefore leave to come. But I say, massa, dey's good sort of fellers after all. Do whatever you tells 'em. Good for go messages, perhaps, and save dis your nigger's poor legs. Ebony made the latter suggestion with a grin so broad that in the darkness his face became almost luminous, with teeth and gums. "Well, I suppose we must make the most of the circumstances," said Orlando. "Come, lead me to them." It was found that though the strong affection of the two chiefs for Zeppa had made them rebellious in the matter of visiting the spot, the same affection and their regard for Orlando rendered them submissive as lambs, and willing to do absolutely whatever they were told. Orlando, therefore, had no difficulty in prevailing on them to delay their visit to his father till the following day. Meanwhile, he caused them to encamp in a narrow pass close at hand, and, the better to reconcile them to their lot, imposed upon them the duty of mounting guard each alternate couple of hours during the night. "He will do well," said the doctor, after examining the patient. "This sleep is life to him. I will give him something when he awakes, but the awaking must be left to nature. Whether he recovers his reason after what he has passed through remains to be seen. You say he has been wandering for some time here in a state of insanity. How came that about?" "It is a long and sad story, doctor," said Orlando, evading the question, "and I have not time to tell it now, for I want you to visit another patient." "Another patient?" repeated the surgeon, in surprise. "Ah, "'One of the natives, I suppose?' "'No, a white man. "'He is a sailor who ran away from his ship "'and was caught by the natives and tortured. "'Come, then, let us go and see the poor fellow at once. "'Does he live far from here?' "'Close at hand,' answered Orlando, as he led the way, "'and perhaps, doctor, it would be well not to question the poor man at present.' As to his being here in such a plight, he seems very weak and ill. When the surgeon had examined Roscoe's feet, he led Orlando aside. It is a bad case, he said. Both legs must be amputated below the knee if the man's life is to be saved. Must it be done now? Immediately. Can you assist me? I have assisted at amateur operations before now, said Orlando, and at all events you can count on the firmness of my nerves and on blind obedience. But stay, I must speak to him first, alone. Roscoe, said the youth, as he knelt by the pirate's couch, your sins have been severely punished, and your endurance sorely tried. Not more than I deserve, Orlando. But I grieve to tell you that your courage must be still further tried. The doctor says that both feet must be amputated. A frown gathered on the pirate's face, and he compressed his lips for a few moments. And the alternative, he asked, is death. Again there was a brief pause. Then he said slowly, almost bitterly, Oh, death! You have hovered over my head pretty steadily of late. It is a question whether I had not better let you come on and end these weary struggles, rather than become a hopeless cripple in the prime of life. Why should I fear death now more than before? Have you any hope of eternal life, Roscoe? How can I tell? What do I know about eternal life? Then you are not prepared to die, and let me earnestly assure you that there is something well worth living for, though at present you do not, you cannot know it. Enough, let it be as the doctor advises, said the pirate in a tone of resignation. That night the operation was successfully performed, and the unfortunate man was afterwards carefully tended by Ebony. Next day Tomeo and Butchie were told that their old friend Zeppa could not yet be seen, but that he required many little comforts from the Furious, which must be brought up with as little delay as possible. That was sufficient. Forgetting themselves in their anxiety to aid their friend, these affectionate warriors went off on their mission, and were soon out of sight. When Zeppa awoke at last with a deep sigh, it was still dark. This was fortunate, for he could not see whose hand administered the physic, and was too listless and weak to inquire. It was bright day when he awoke the second time, and looked up inquiringly in his son's face. "'What, are you still there, Orly?' he said faintly, while the habitual sweet expression stole over his pale features, though it was quickly followed by the perplexed look. "'But how comes this change? You look so much older than you are, dear boy. Would God that I could cease this dreaming?' "'You are not dreaming now, father. I am indeed Orly. You have been ill and delirious, but, thanks be to God, are getting well again. What? Exclaimed the invalid. Has it been all a dream, then? Were you not thrown into the sea by the mutineers, and have I not been wandering for months or years on a desert island? But then, if these things be all dreams, he added, opening his eyes wide and fixing them intently on Orlando's face. How come it that I still dream the change in you. You are Orly, yet not Orly. How is that? Yes, all that is true, dear, dear father, said the youth, gently clasping one of the helpless hands that lay crossed on Zeppa's broad chest. I was thrown overboard by the mutineers years ago, but, thank God, I was not drowned, and you have been wandering here in very ill for years. But, thank God again, you are better, and I have been mercifully sent to deliver you. I can't believe it, Orly, for I have so often seen you, and you have so often given me the slip. Yet there does seem something very real about you just now, very real, though so changed. Yet it is the same voice, and you never spoke to me before in my dreams except once. Yes, I think it was once that you spoke. I remember it well, for the sound sent such a thrill to my heart. Oh, God forbid that it should again fade away, as it has done so often. It will not fade, father. The time you speak of was only yesterday, when I found you. You have been sleeping since, and a doctor is attending you. A doctor? Where did he come from? At that moment, Ebony approached, with some food in a tin pan. The invalid observed him at once. Ebony, can that be you? Why, when, oh, my poor brain feels so light, it seems as if a puff of wind would blow it away. I must have been very ill. Zeppa spoke feebly and closed his eyes, from which one or two tears issued, blessed tears, the first he had shed for many a day. His reason is restored, whispered the doctor in Orlando's ear, but he must be left to rest. Orlando's heart was too full to find relief through the lips. I cannot understand it at all, resumed Zeppa, reopening his eyes. Least of all can I understand you, Orly, but my hope is in God. I would sleep now, but you must not let go my hand. Orlando held it tighter. One word more. Your dear mother is well and longs to see you. A profound, long-drawn sigh followed, as if an insupportable burden had been removed from the wearied soul, and Zeppa sank into a sleep so peaceful that it seemed as if the spirit had forsaken the worn-out frame. But a steady, gentle heaving of the chest told that life was still there. During the hours that followed, Orlando sat quite motionless, like a statue, firmly grasping his father's hand. End of chapter 12.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets, with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.